城市匆忙，我总迷失方向。路上行人神色慌张，我内心冰凉。
Welcome to another episode of Blow Your Mind. Today's guest is historian and journalist Kai Bird. Kai is the author of American Prometheus, The Triumph and Tragedy of J. Robert Oppenheimer, for which he won the Pulitzer Prize. The movie based on the book was released earlier this year. Many of our listeners have probably seen it. Kai's other works include The Outlier, The Unfinished Presidency of Jimmy Carter, and The Chairman, John J. McCloy and the Making of the American Establishment. Kai is also the executive director of the Leon Levy Center for Biography. Kai, welcome to the show and welcome to Shanghai.
Thank you, Feng.
Your book, American Prometheus, is about Oppenheimer. So who was Oppenheimer and why is it important to learn about his life?
Well, Robert Oppenheimer is a very mysterious character who symbolizes our atomic age. You know, he was born in 1904 in New York City, very privileged childhood, growing up in the Upper West Side of Manhattan. His father was rather wealthy. As a young boy, he expressed an interest in science, collecting rocks and then studying chemistry and eventually physics at Harvard. He sort of came of age right on the cusp of quantum physics, the discovery by Niels Bohr, the Danish physicist of quantum. And he became a great theoretical physicist who brought quantum physics to America and started one of the earliest departments of physics at Berkeley, California in the 1920s. And then, of course, he became the scientific director in 1942 of the secret city in Los Alamos, New Mexico, where they built the first atomic bomb.
He showed extraordinary talent even at a very early age. In the book, there was this story of he was 12 and he was invited to give a presentation at the Geological Society.
Yes.
And, it's extraordinary.
And they hadn't realized that they were in correspondence with a 12-year-old. So when he shows up to give his lecture, they had to get a soapbox for him to stand on.
Did he get a lot of encouragement from his parents about his intellectual pursuits, especially in the sciences and physics and mathematics?
Oh, absolutely. You know, his father was an immigrant from Germany of Jewish ancestry. His mother was also of German ancestry, but born in Baltimore, Maryland.
But his father wasn't particularly intellectual.
Not an intellectual. He was a businessman and made a small fortune in clothing manufacture in New York. And so young Oppenheimer grew up in the Upper West Side in Manhattan in a 10-room apartment. He had a cook and a nanny and a maid and a chauffeur, and his father bought him a sailboat at one point when he was a teenager, which he named Trimethy after the chemical. And yeah, he showed evidence at a very early age for an interest in science and chemistry in particular, and then physics. And, you know, his parents pampered him, protected him. His mother was a painter, an accomplished artist, and a collector of early Picassos and Van Goghs. So the young Oppenheimer grew up in an apartment surrounded by this great art. But he was also, I should say, and this will be of interest to your younger listeners, you know, he was sort of a socially awkward young boy who was a little arrogant at times, and he had a prolonged adolescence. And at the age of 22, studying in Cambridge, England, when he was studying experimental physics, he had essentially a nervous breakdown or an emotional crisis of some sort, which we call the poison apple incident.
It's grad school for you.
It's grad school. Well, it you know, for Oppenheimer, going to Cambridge after finishing his BA at Harvard in 3 years, he arrives in Cambridge and studies experimental physics, and it turns out he's awkward with his hands. He's just not very, you know, he breaks things in the laboratory, and so he's facing failure for the first time, and this is emotionally disturbing to him, and he has a serious, you know, crisis.
Mm. Up until that point, when he was in grad school, when he faced his first lifetime crisis, he's been successful all along.
Yes.
Okay, so that was the first, the real challenge he faced.
Yeah, absolutely. And we don't really know quite what happened, but something happened.
And the poison apple was involved at some point.
Well, there may have been a poison apple involved that he left on his tutor's desk. Again, we don't know why, or whether this was a metaphor, or whether there was a real poisoned apple that he left on the desk. But something happened to cause the Cambridge University authorities to either put him on probation or almost suspend him. And in any case, his parents intervened and assured the university authorities that they would take care of this. They would send him to an analyst, a psychologist, a Freudian.
In high school and in college, I loved physics. The incident with the poison apple was folklore, so every student of physics have read about it. What really shocked me was how easy he got away with it. But I'd imagine if it were real. I mean, there's some debate about how real the incident was, but if it were real, like...
Yeah, was it attempted murder?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there were no charges, and he wasn't even expelled from the school.
Yeah, we really don't know, because the Cambridge records from that time, disciplinary records, have been destroyed. So what we have is evidence of what happened is Oppenheimer's own stories to his friends, and particularly stories from some of his friends who wrote this down in a memoir and such. But clearly he was in distress, and he did see a psychologist on Harley Street, who was probably Ernest Jones, the great biographer of Freud later on. The story is that he had several sessions with Jones, and then young Oppenheimer stormed out one day and said, that man isn't smart enough to talk to me.
Not surprising.
And then to finish this little anecdote, his parents apparently took him to Paris and arranged an appointment with a French psychologist who talked to the young Oppenheimer and then prescribed red wine and the professional services of a woman.
What's that supposed to mean? Why did they feel that was needed? And that's part of his
That his
treatment.
Problem was sexual. Sexual frustration. I think that's a very French diagnosis. But maybe it was pretty much on the mark.
Apparently it helped.
Again, we're a little uncertain, but... again, something happened, and he somehow overcame this period of crisis during a spring break trip around the same time, that same year, to Corsica, where he went to Corsica with several friends. And according to his own explanation, something happened that was involving love, but not a love affair.
A great love of some sort.
And one...
Maybe a metaphor.
But we do know that... This may have been another metaphor, but we do know that he fell in love with Marcel Proust and his writings. Mm. This sort of existential novel, it helped him to overcome and reassured him that maybe his own anxieties were not so bizarre or abnormal. Anyway, he very soon thereafter discovered theoretical physics and discovered that he was good at that and not good at experimental. So he transferred from Cambridge to Göttingen, Germany, and studied under Max Born and met Ernest Werner Heisenberg and other great German physicists, and wrote his PhD in less than a year and was offered a professorship at Berkeley, where he started the first sort of physics department on quantum physics.
And he became a rising star in the world of physics research. And then the big event that took place thereafter is the war and the Manhattan Project. How did Oppenheimer get to be picked to lead the Manhattan Project?
Well, this too is a mystery, an improbable. You know, he was in 1942. He was 38 years old, and he'd never administered anything but a handful of graduate students. Despite this background, despite his inexperience as an administrator, General Leslie Groves, the general in charge of the Manhattan Project, who was going around the country interviewing scientists and trying to figure out who should lead this project to build what they called the gadget. When he finally interviewed young Oppenheimer in Berkeley, he realized that this was a young man who was A, extremely ambitious, and B, obviously quite brilliant. And though he had not yet won and never would win a Nobel Prize, like some of the scientists who were being recruited to this project, he had an ability to talk in plain English to Groves about what was necessary. And, you know, he wasn't just a theoretical physicist. He, by the time he was 38, he was a professor of physics, but also he wrote poetry. He loved literature. He read the novels of Ernest Hemingway. He loved the poetry of T.S. Eliot. You know, he was a polymath. And so he could speak to someone like Groves very clearly and eloquently. And he had one brilliant idea that Groves thought qualified him to become director, which was Groves, he indicated to Oppenheimer that he was obsessed with secrecy and maintaining security over what they were doing. Oppenheimer explained to him that, well, they were never going to be successful in building this gadget if they didn't allow all the scientists to congregate in one place and talk to each other and collaborate. You couldn't keep them spread out all over universities and laboratories all over the country. And instead, you should bring them all to one isolated spot. And Oppenheimer suggested this tiny little spot called Los Alamos, which the only thing that existed there was the Los Alamos Boys School, an elite sort of high school for the rich, and take that over and put a barbed wire fence around it and build a secret city and bring all these scientists to collaborate inside so that they could talk about anything inside the barbed wire fence, but not be allowed out without permission. And so Groves understood that this was a brilliant idea administratively. It would allow him to maintain control, and it would allow Oppenheimer to lead this team to collaborate on solving the problem of how to build the first atomic bomb.
The choice of Oppenheimer as leading the scientific effort of the Manhattan Project, and also his great success at doing that, came as a surprise to me, because as you were just saying, and you said this in the book, that Oppenheimer could be very kind to his students, but he had a thing about anyone who's in the authority figure, or
he
anyone
didn't like authority figures.
And also he had trouble working with anyone who is his intellectual equal, mm-hmm. as one of his friends was describing him. Yet he did a great job at recruiting these scientists, convinced them to all work together, be effective in the competition, in the research. So how did this happen? Did he change as the role was thrust upon him? Or he always had this in him?
Well, I think he had a demonstrated capability to transform himself. You know, he had this emotional, nervous breakdown crisis of some sort when he was 22, but he overcame it somehow. When he became a professor at Berkeley, initially he was a terrible teacher. He mumbled and talked to students with his back to them, scribbling formula on the blackboard. But he learned to become eloquent as a lecturer and charismatic, and he built up a following of students. And likewise at Los Alamos, you know, he really wanted to do this. He was concerned that Heisenberg and the other German physicists that he had known in Germany would be ahead in the race to build this weapon and would get it to Hitler in time for Hitler to use it to win the war for fascism. And Oppenheimer thought this was his, you know, worst nightmare. So he was desperate to build this weapon, and he understood that it was going to take, initially he thought several hundred scientists, and then it grew to eventually thousands, scientists and non-scientists, 6,000 in Los Alamos. He transformed himself into a charismatic leader. And typically his style of management was interesting in that he didn't come into a meeting and stand at the front of the room and try to direct things. He allowed a free flow of conversation and argument, and then precisely at the right moment, he would step forward and summarize what everyone had been saying, and summarize it in a way that was sensitive to all these large egos, and synthesize their arguments in a way that made it clear what was the next step to solving this particular problem. So he very quickly attracted respect, and people were willing to follow his leadership.
So this was at the height of his success and reputation. Then what happened?
Well, in 2.5 years, he successfully built the gadget and tested it at Trinity in the desert, southern desert of New Mexico. You know, by that time, the war in Europe was over. Hitler was dead. And they actually had a meeting in Los Alamos to discuss, well, why are we working so hard to build this terrible weapon when the only enemy that could possibly have acquired it is already defeated, and we don't believe the Japanese have this capability. So why do this? Oppenheimer, again, allowed this meeting to go forward, allowed them to argue, and then stepped forward and said, well, I want to remind you of what Niels Bohr told us when he arrived in Los Alamos on the last day of 1943, having escaped from Nazi Europe. He had one question for Robert Oppenheimer. It was, Robert, can you tell me if it is big enough? The implication was, you know, is it big enough to end all war? This is an intriguing argument, but Oppenheimer used it to persuade his scientists to continue. Only one physicist resigned from Los Alamos, Joseph Rotblat. And the argument was sort of maybe a rationalization. The argument is that if this gadget is not demonstrated to humanity dramatically in this war, and people see how awful it is, then they won't understand the nature of the weapon, that is one bomb that can destroy a whole city, the apocalyptic nature of it. And then, therefore, the next war will be fought by two or three or four adversaries, all of whom would be armed with nuclear weapons. And that would be, you know, the end of civilization. That would be apocalyptic. So that's the argument, and it's an intriguing argument, and it was persuasive in that instance. But at the same time, Oppenheimer was, you know, capable of worrying about the consequences of what he was doing.
But did Oppenheimer buy that argument?
He did. Oh, yeah, he bought that argument. Niels Bohr planted that notion, that question with him, and he thought it was persuasive. And I think, you know, he also is just having invested 2.5 years in trying to make this gadget work. He wanted to see if it would work. As a scientist, it was an experiment.
That's perfectly understandable.
And perfectly human.
Mm-hmm. In fact, he might be, you know, looking for a reason to keep working on this project.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
And that sounds a plausible reason.
This is a plausible argument, mm-hmm. And it came from Niels Bohr. But, you know, at the same time, you have to say that he's more complicated than that. So in July of 1945, after the Trinity success, I interviewed Ann Wilson, his last secretary at Los Alamos, and she told me that one day she was walking to work with Oppie. He suddenly started muttering to himself, those poor little people, those poor little people. She stopped him and said, well, Robert, what are you talking about? And he says, well, Trinity was a success. We now know the gadget will work. And it's now going to be used on a Japanese city. the victims are going to be those poor little people, women and children and old men and not many soldiers. There's no military target large enough other than a city for such a weapon. So what's particularly astonishing about that anecdote is that when I told it to Marty Sherwin, my co-author, who spent 20 years before I joined him on this project, he did all this research, he said, well, you know, that was, chronologically speaking, that was the same week that Oppenheimer was meeting with the bombardiers who were going to be on the Enola Gay to drop the first atomic bomb. And he was instructing them at exactly what altitude it should be released and what altitude it should be detonated to have the maximum destructive power and kill the most people. So Oppenheimer was doing his duty, delivering this terrible weapon to the generals who were going to use it. And at the same time, he was worrying about the consequences, the tragedy for tens of thousands of people who were going to be victims of it. Very complicated guy.
And all the more reason that he needed a reason to justify everything that he's doing.
He's endlessly fascinating. And, you know, after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we know from his wife Kitty's letters that he plunged into a deep depression. And she wrote to a friend saying, oh, Robert is in a terrible way, and I don't know if he's going to survive. Meaning, you know, maybe he's going to take his own life. He's so deeply depressed. But he recovers from this. Again, he transforms himself. And he's now a national celebrity, profiles in the New York Times. And he also learns, he goes back to Washington, and he gets briefed by Secretary of War Stimson. And he suddenly realizes from the briefings that, you know, the Japanese were already very close to surrendering anyway, and maybe the bomb was unnecessary. So in October of 1945, just 3 months after Hiroshima, he begins to give speeches in which he says things like, these are weapons for aggressors. They're weapons of terror. And they were used on an essentially already defeated enemy. And you may think that they are expensive, but they are actually cheap. And any society, however poor, that wants to develop these weapons, well, there are no secrets. You know, so he was predicting, he was being very prophetic about the world we live in today. You know, so he spends actually the next few years trying to warn Americans and the world about the dangers of these weapons.
The book is Triumph and Tragedy, and this would eventually yes. lead to the second part of the book.
When I came aboard the project and started working with Marty Sherwin, you know, at one point Marty turned to me and he said, you know, Kai, you and I would not be spending all these years working on this book if it was just a story about the building of this terrible weapon, if it was just the story of the father of the atomic bomb. That wouldn't have interested Marty. He said, you know, what gave the story an arc, a real compelling mystery, is what happened to Oppenheimer after the war. So in 1945, you know, his image is put on the cover of Time and Life, and he becomes, you know, known as America's most celebrated scientist, and aside from Albert Einstein. Then 9 years later, he's destroyed in this kangaroo court of a security hearing, and he's humiliated and put through this secret trial for over a month, and then stripped of his security clearance. And then the entire transcript of these proceedings are leaked to the New York Times, and he's publicly humiliated. And the suggestion is out there that he was disloyal to America and he was maybe a spy. And of course, there's no evidence of any of this. And what happened to him in 1954 was, you know, a travesty. But it sent a message to all scientists everywhere, but particularly in America, to beware of getting out of your narrow lane and pretend that you can be a public intellectual and talk about policy and politics, and because you could be tarred and feathered.
Veer out of your sort of narrow lane.
Narrow lane, yeah.
Scientific research.
Stay in your
little... Be a scientist.
Just be a scientist, yeah. Nothing more. Well, this is a terrible message, in my opinion, for where we are today as a global society drenched in science and technology. And of course, we're on the cutting edge now of another revolution in science with
artificial intelligence.
Artificial intelligence. And so we're at another Oppenheimer moment. That's exactly what the phrase that Sam Altman and others who are developing AI use to describe where we are, where we should be sort of talking about the ethical issues involved in AI in the same way that Oppenheimer was talking about the ethics of relying for your security on these weapons of terror. And we should be finding some way to, in a rational way, to get the benefits of AI, like Oppenheimer would argue the benefits of atomic energy or medical research, or but regulate it and contain it and set guardrails so that it's not used, you know, in a disruptive and negative way on human society. Anyway, what happens to Oppenheimer is a travesty in 1954, and it's a mystery how it happened, and it's a mystery story. And I'm really glad that Christopher Nolan in his film devotes, you know, really half the film to the trial, because that's the real story. It's not just, it's not the building of this weapon. It's what happens to him as a consequence.
There's so many different directions I want to follow after that comment, but just focusing on Oppenheimer for a bit longer. So there's this private security hearing. My understanding is that he was stripped off of his security clearance, but he remained as a director at the Institute for Advanced Studies. In fact, he led, from what I can gather, he led a pretty fruitful and successful, I would even say, career even afterwards.
Well, sort of, yes. He kept his job as the director of the Institute for Advanced Studies.
So still a very influential position.
But he almost lost that job, because the man who had railroaded him,
Louis Strauss,
and orchestrated the security hearing that brought him down, also was chairman of the board of trustees at the Institute, and tried to get Oppenheimer fired.
In fact, that's one, I think if you're just watching the film, it might get it was a little bit confusing for me. The film made that Louis Strauss and Oppenheimer were like butting heads, and yet Louis Strauss, at the beginning of the film, invited Oppenheimer to become the director.
Yes.
So it was only after reading the book I sort of figured out what happened before what. So there was like a time sequence of events.
Yeah. Louis Strauss was a very insecure but powerful bureaucrat who had no more than a high school education, so thus his insecurity in front of someone like Oppenheimer.
In fact, in the film, there was a scene where Oppenheimer kind of slighted,
yes,
or perceived to have slighted Strauss.
Yeah, oh, he did that repeatedly to Strauss. They didn't like each other in the end, but Strauss had offered and hired
Oppenheimer for
the job as director in 1947, and recruited him to come to Princeton, and it was a great job. You know, Oppenheimer did not want to work any longer in Los Alamos on nuclear weapons. In fact, he told the president of the United States, well, I think you should close Los Alamos down and give it back to the Indians, was the
private school, the boys' school.
Yeah. So he accepted this job at Princeton, which was a perfect fit for a theoretical physicist who also had an interest in history and literature. The Institute is something that started in the early 30s to gather the brightest minds and just let them think. They don't have to teach. They just gather, they give them a stipend, a lifetime fellowship, and there are dozens of them, and they're really interesting people, and Oppenheimer loved
one of the most coveted job if you're a
coveted
scientist.
Job, yeah. Came with a good salary and a beautiful house on the grounds, and Einstein, you know, Oppenheimer got
my understanding is that you don't even need to teach.
No, he doesn't.
There are no
teach.
Students.
Yes. No students.
Nice job if you can get it.
Yeah. Well, he almost lost it because Strauss tried to get him fired. Failed only because the rest of the Institute, all the fellows, signed a letter sent to Strauss saying, if Oppie goes, we're resigning too. So Strauss had to back off. But, you know, he was, after the 54 hearing.
Sound is just like what happened at OpenAI very recently. ChatGPT.
Oh, that's right.
Almost sounds like a replay of.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Hence the parallel between nuclear science and artificial intelligence.
But Oppenheimer was certainly, without a doubt, he was terribly wounded by what happened in 54. And yes, he retained his job at the Institute, but, you know, he never did any new physics. He just spent his time presiding and recruiting interesting people like George Kennan. He recruited poets and historians. And
that's a new too. Yeah. To the Institute,
yeah.
Because before that, it was primarily focusing on science and mathematics.
Mathematics, and it was heavily populated by mathematicians. But Oppenheimer had, you know, these broad interests, and so he stopped being a public intellectual. He stopped speaking out. He was often, you know, early in 54, 55, 56, he was just disinvited from giving speeches at universities. He was that controversial. But people in the scientific community understood that what had happened to him was a travesty, and there were efforts to rehabilitate him occasionally. And one of his friends was McGeorge Bundy, the Harvard dean, who I wrote a biography of called The Color of Truth. Bundy was so outraged by what Louis Strauss had done to Oppenheimer that he briefed Kennedy, young Senator Kennedy, and told him, you know, you need to understand what happened to Oppenheimer, and you should vote against the confirmation of Louis Strauss as Commerce Secretary in 1959 when Eisenhower nominated him for that position. And that's exactly what Kennedy did, and it led to, ironically, the downfall of Strauss.
It almost seemed as if Oppenheimer had the last laugh.
In a way, yeah.
In a way. So completing the story arc.
Nolan, in his film, uses that to complete the circle. But otherwise, you know, it is a personal tragedy for Oppenheimer. You know, right after the hearing, he retreats literally to the Caribbean, to the Virgin Islands, to St. John, and takes his family to get them away from the glare of the publicity in the aftermath of the 54 security hearing. And they go on a sailing trip in the Caribbean, and he falls in love with St. John in the Virgin Islands, buys a small plot of land right on the beach, builds a cabin, and he spends the rest of his life there 3 or 4 months of the year, every year, hiding from the world and being a beach bum and sailing.
I'm tempted to say that's not so bad.
It's not so bad, but you know, for a man who was sort of
sure compared to what he had before,
a public figure, and a man who enjoyed being on the national stage and having access to power.
I mean, it's not the life that he wanted.
Life that he wanted, but he was so personally wounded by what had happened that he literally retreated.
Why did he insist on going to the hearing when Einstein advised against it?
Yes.
I mean, when Einstein advised, you tend to listen. And also, did he see through the setup? Did he see through there was a foregone conclusion?
No.
So he did have some hope of getting a fair hearing.
He was very naive politically. And the scene in the movie, in this conversation between Oppenheimer and Einstein, comes right out of the book. It's all true because we have a witness to the conversation. And, you know, Oppenheimer was explaining to Einstein why he had to be absent for a month down in Washington to attend this hearing. And Albert says, well,
don't go.
Don't go. Why are you subjecting yourself to this terrible witch hunt if these people don't want you anymore? Walk
away.
So even
Einstein saw through it.
Einstein saw through it. Oppenheimer argued with him and said, no, I need to go. I need to use my influence to retain my security clearance so that I can continue to talk to presidents and senators and generals and warn them about the bomb. He left, turned around and walked away, and Einstein turns to his secretary and says, there goes Anar. the Yiddish word for a fool. So Einstein understood that.
Einstein knew
that Oppy was being politically foolish and naive. And I think Oppy thought that he could explain his way through the security hearing, use his prestige, and he would triumph over it. He had no idea how rigged the whole thing was and that he would not be able to defend himself.
So he wasn't aware that he was walking into a trap.
Yeah.
My reading on this was he's a very smart man, but maybe sort of naive to the power play. But he was also blinded by his urge of playing a part.
Yeah, he wanted to retain his power, his access to the establishment and to the hallways of the Senate and the Pentagon. He had enjoyed that. He had been seduced by that celebrity and the power of having access to these people. So it was his weakness that led him into this in a way. His naivete, but his
weakness. That was the tragedy of him, yeah. I'd like to go back to something I said earlier about your co-author, Marty, who described this story arc. What would make a good story arc?
Well, you know, human beings love stories. It's the only way we can understand our world. So we tell stories to each other. The best stories have, you know, an arc, an up and a down. And we're fascinated by failure and defeat and
because
tragedies.
That's something we can all relate to.
That's something that we can all, because we all, you know, have our little defeats and tragedies and disappointments in life. And so that's what gives a story an arc, as they say.
So there must be an up and a
down. There must be some, you know, it's boring to read about someone who's just always successful. you can't empathize.
On that, I was reading an interview with David McCullough.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interview he gave at the Paris Review. He talked about how he wanted to write a biography of Picasso, but then quit because, I'm paraphrasing, but he said something along the lines of Picasso has just always been successful. It's not a very interesting life, even though, you know, he changed how we look at things, but his life as a star is not that interesting.
Yeah, it was sort of just a flat lineup, one success after another.
Could there be another arc to his story? I mean, he's a very complicated, very, very storied life. Could there be another arc that would also work? I want to frame it as a more general question when you come to this project. Could there be different biographers teasing out different story arcs out of the same person?
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's sort of why we have multiple biographies about the same individual. You know, biography is a subjective art. It's not objective. You know, it's my story, my narrative about Oppenheimer. It's influenced by my views and my prejudices and bias and what interests me about the story. Marty and I wrote about Oppenheimer and his quantum physics, his encounter with quantum physics. And we tried to explain a little bit about some of the problems he was investigating, black hole theory and such. But there's not a single formula in the book. there's not a lot of physics in this book. You know, what interests us was his personal life, his love affairs, his relationship with Kitty, who was a fascinating figure in her own right, and his politics, and of course what happened to him after being father of the atomic bomb and being crucified in this kangaroo court.
Between the two of you, did you ever disagree on something, the story arc, how to portray a person?
You know, when Marty came to me, it was 20 years into his project. I had written two biographies by that time. So this was the year 2000. But
those two biographies had been solo work.
Yes, I had written them alone. And actually, both of those biographies about John McCloy and McGeorge Bundy, both of these men were friends of Oppenheimer. And so I'd had to write a little bit about their relationship. So I knew something about Oppenheimer and his significance. But I really knew that this was Marty's project, and he was known for two decades now to be working on this. And so I was kind of reluctant, you know. So I actually told Marty initially, you know, Marty, I like you too much to join you on this.
Why did he come to you? Did you know each other before?
Yeah, we had gotten to know each other over the years. Initially, I met him when I was in my late 20s, early 30s. I was an assistant editor at The Nation magazine, a liberal weekly in New York, and Marty wrote for it occasionally. And so I ended up editing some of his journalism as such. And then we got to know each other much more closely in 1994-95, when an enormous controversy broke out in Washington over the Smithsonian Museum, the National Museum in Washington, that planned an exhibit on the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II and the atomic bombings. They planned an exhibit that was quite complicated with nuanced history from both the Japanese side and the American side, and critics of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and proponents of it. And at the centerpiece was going to be this display of the actual airplane, the Enola Gay, that dropped the first atomic bomb. Unfortunately, the planning document for this 10,000 square foot exhibit was leaked to the American Legionnaires and the U.S. Air Force Association lobby organizations for veterans, who announced that this was subversive, unpatriotic history.
Because it included critics.
Because it included critics. And so they demanded that certain things be censored, like a statement from Dwight Eisenhower, the general and president, who in his memoirs called the use of this weapon barbaric. Eventually, these people attacking the museum were successful. They got the museum to fold, to pare down the exhibit, to cancel everything except the Enola Gay, which was presented as a triumph of American technology, and that was it. So Marty and I were outraged by this, and we worked together. We formed a little committee of historians to try to defend the museum, the archivists and curators in the museum, and we failed, and the museum's director was fired. It was a disaster, but it threw Marty and I together, and we became good friends. So that was in 95, and then a few years later, I finished my biography of McGeorge Bundy in 98. It was published. So I was sort of in between jobs when he approached me, in between books. And he realized he was having trouble finishing this project.
20 years, I can imagine. But he always envisioned that there's a book. The ultimate goal is to have a book on Oppenheimer.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. His intention was to write the biography for Oppenheimer. And by that time, he'd collected 50,000 pages of archival documents, including...
Did you have to read it all?
Yeah.
Most of them.
Okay. Including 8,000 pages of FBI documents, and he'd done 150 interviews. They were all neatly transcribed. You know, he was an amazing historian. Anyway, he persuaded me to join him eventually, and... We got to work together in the year 2000, and it still took 5 years to write the book. And once I started writing the early chapters, that stimulated him to jump in and start writing, and we went back and forth, and it became a terrific, you know, collaboration. And the book came out in 2005, and the next year, before we won the Pulitzer, it was optioned for film, which was very exciting. We thought at the time, oh, Hollywood comes knocking. But then nothing happened.
Since there was an auction, I assume someone bought it.
Well, when they option it, they give you a little money to reserve. You know, they own the option for making a film.
So they don't know if they're going to make it.
They don't promise they're going to make it, but they have exclusive rights to make it for a limited time, 2 years, and then they renewed for another 2 years. And this party had it for 4 years, and... did a script, but couldn't sell it to any studio. And then another party came along and tried again and failed after 4 years. And by that time, we thought this is never going to happen. You know, it's too complicated a story. too controversial, nuclear weapons and Hiroshima. And finally, another party came along, optioned it in 2015. Again, a long time ago. They wrote a script. It was terrible.
When they write the script, do they send it to you?
Yes, eventually. And they showed us this third attempt at a script, and it was just awful, so bad that Marty and I had to write a long memo listing the 108 historical inaccuracies in the script.
That's a very exact number.
That persuaded the fellow who had bought the film option to back off and to... And instead, this person, Dave Wargo is his name, he's someone who studied physics at MIT, so he had an interest in the science, and he'd become a businessman, and he was determined to make this happen. So Dave Wargo actually, finally in the winter of 2021, flew out to Hollywood in the midst of the pandemic in a private jet, got the book into the hands of Christopher Nolan.
Did he always want Nolan to make
the film? No, this just happened by happenstance. Nolan read the book in March of 21, loved it, decided on speculation, without contacting us. He sat down and spent the 4 months trying to hit his hand at writing a screenplay. And he wrote a very long screenplay, 180 pages in 4 months.
I mean, it was a long film. It was 3 hours.
Yeah. Finally, in September of 2021, I got a phone call saying that Christopher Nolan wanted to talk to me and Marty. Well, Marty, by that time, was ailing with small cell lung cancer. And he was 84, and he couldn't travel up to New York. So I went up alone and met Nolan, and... Nolan, at that point, was willing to answer all my questions about what he intended and what kind of a film he wanted, but he was unwilling to share the screenplay with me. So it was, I was hopeful, but...
Maybe
I
heard from the previous guy about the
Well, these authors can be trouble, you know? Typically, Hollywood is very skeptical of authors because they get in the way of the filmmaker. I don't know, but Nolan is a very smart, emotionally intelligent director, and he works entirely alone and confidentially. He answered freely all my questions, what was in the movie, what was not, how much was devoted to the trial, for instance. And so he was reassuring verbally. And then in February of 2022, he called again and said he wanted to meet again, and this time he wanted to show me the screenplay. He was just about to start filming, and he wanted to make sure that there weren't any hidden mistakes in the screenplay. So I read it in a hotel room in New York. It took me 4 hours.
Almost as long as you would watch the film.
And it's an amazing script, and I was sort of blown away by it. And it brought back, all the memories I had of working with Marty on the book, and I could recognize whole pieces of dialogue that came straight out of the book. And so I thought it was terrific. But of course, by that time, 2 weeks after my first meeting with Nolan, Marty had died. So he died knowing that there was something in the works, but it's terribly tragic that he's not here to see the movie and to see all the attention that the book is getting 18 years after its publication.
That's a long story arc right there, too.
Yeah, exactly.
So the film is very successful. I've heard on other interviews that you really like the film. Would you like more of your work to be turned into films?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think people are bored by films about superheroes with capes.
It's just an endless supply of
Just like, really, why don't they focus on real stories? Film is so powerful. It could convey and stimulate a lot of discussions about real history that we need to be informed about. Actually, one of my previous books is called The Good Spy, and it's a biography of a CIA clandestine officer, a real story Robert Ames, who spent 23 years in the CIA, working largely in the Middle East. And then he was killed in the first truck bomb attack on a U.S. embassy in Beirut. So it's a mystery story about what happened to him and what he did in his career. And it's a spy story. So it is...
good film material.
It's a good film material. It's under film option. There is a script written. I'm trying to say that maybe someday it'll be produced, but it's, you know, I've learned from Hollywood to be very skeptical. It's a terrible business model they have.
As all the superhero films.
Yeah, they option lots of books and subjects, and very few of them actually make it onto the big screen.
I watched a panel. You were there and Nolan was there. Nolan said something that struck me as just very insightful. He said that the film is 3 hours long because he couldn't make it into a shorter film. If it turned into a normal length shorter film, it would just be boring.
Mm-hmm.
When I got the book, the first impression was this is a big volume book. I'm wondering, is the same also true for the book format? Like you couldn't turn it into a shorter book because it would actually be boring. But at the same time, such a big book would dissuade some readers from picking it up.
Right. It is intimidating to look at an 800-page book with almost 100 pages of footnotes. And but if you actually try to crack open American Prometheus and start reading at the beginning, parts of it reads like a novel. It's very personal about Oppenheimer. There's drama. And Marty and I like to pay attention, particularly at the beginning and the end of each chapter, to make sure that there was some colorful or dramatic anecdote or quotation that would make the reader, curious and curious to go on to the next chapter. And yeah, biography by nature typically is, most biographers take at least 5 years to do their work, often longer. Typically, they can't write a short biography. You're trying to explore another human life, and it's very complicated. And you worry all the time about what is left out. And you have to make many decisions about what to leave out. And so thus the subjectivity of any biography. But at the same time, you're trying to establish a relationship with your reader and establish credibility that, yes, you can rest assured that I'm an honest storyteller. Look at my footnotes. If I have a quote here, check it out, see where it came from. And let you try to tell the story to be able to let them, the reader, judge what happened. Coming back to the poison apple incident early in Oppenheimer's life, it is kind of a mysterious thing. And so we lay it out and let the reader decide either, oh, this is unbelievable, he couldn't have done this, or, well, he was very disturbed and look at all the evidence that he was on the cusp of destroying himself. And so that's the challenge. And you can't do that often in a short fashion. It takes time to lay it out.
It'll be boring if you do it in a short fashion.
Right.
How did you decide, or how did you become a biographer?
I grew up overseas, outside of America, in the Middle East and India, and then went back to college to go to America and discovered that I was, that I was a foreigner in my own country. I really didn't know America. So as a young man, I drifted into journalism. And I think in retrospect, it was a way to sort of understand my country, to be an observer, to write about it. After 10 years of journalism, which is very good practice for writing, for storytelling, interviewing, doing research in an archive, I decided I wanted to write a book. And by just happenstance, I landed on the life of John J. McCloy, this powerful Wall Street lawyer. And I thought he would be a metaphor for explaining, this is in 1980, for explaining the 1979 energy crisis that had just happened, where there were long gas lines as a result of the revolution in Iran and the instability in the oil markets. And having grown up in the Middle East and Saudi Arabia, I was interested in the sort of nexus between big oil companies and American foreign policy in the Middle East. And McCloy was a figure that could represent all this. He was a lawyer who represented all 22 American oil companies. But then once I got into the research, I realized he'd done all these other things. He had an incredible resume, always behind the scenes as an operator. And he gradually, you know, he was essentially the unnamed chairman of the American foreign policy establishment, who had advised every president from Franklin Roosevelt through Reagan. So it became a biography. And I thought it would take 2.5 years.
Well, it was your first major work.
It was my first major work, and it took 10 years. it was a huge effort, and it was an 800-page book in the end. And by the time I was finished, I thought I'd go back to journalism, but I couldn't get a job. No one would hire me in journalism anymore. They thought of me as a biographer. And so I did another one. And it took only 7 years.
Given that it takes 5 years or more to write a biography, so it's a huge time investment, how do you decide who to write about?
Because it's such an investment of time and money, it's very expensive to do all this research, to go to archives. You have to really be invested, curious about this life. So all my books have been motivated by my subjective biases and interests. And, you know, I wanted to understand with John McCloy, it became a quest to understand how power works in America. And that's sort of been a theme for all of my biographies. How does, you know, the elite, and there are elites even in a democracy, how do they navigate the wheels between big corporations and foundations and the government and the political electorate? You know, how does that work? And how do, you know, so McCloy is a great example of that, but so is McGeorge Bundy, who was a Harvard dean and national security advisor and an architect of the war in Vietnam. And I chose him because as a young man, I thought, this man is a war criminal. As an architect of the war in Vietnam. And so when I went back to America to go to college in 1969, the war was still raging, and Bundy was still a public figure, no longer in government. He was working at the Ford Foundation, but he was clearly a liberal too. And he came and gave a lecture at my college when I was a senior, and I couldn't understand how this man could be so suave and sophisticated and articulate and obviously a liberal, an intellectual, former Harvard dean, and yet he had done Vietnam. He had gotten us into this terrible war, and he was still defending it. This was 1972. And so that curiosity stayed with me. I wanted to, you know, years later, after finishing McCloy, I proposed, you know, to my editor at Simon & Schuster, how about McGeorge Bundy and his brother Bill, actually, so it was a dual biography. And so I was selecting him because I wanted to find out what had motivated him, what had happened, you know, what was the tragedy that persuaded such a smart man to lead us into such a terrible war.
So you came into the project with a certain impression of opinion of this
sure.
person. Did you change your mind?
I had to interview him and go through the archives, and you know, it was clear he wasn't a war criminal. He was well intentioned, and it turns out much of his motivation goes back to the fact that he was a liberal, advising liberal presidents like Kennedy and Johnson At a time that was just 10 years after the height of McCarthyism, liberals worried about, you know, John Kennedy as a president in the early 60s, was grappling with this little war in Vietnam, which was a civil war, you know, between the North and the South. And, you know, Bundy, it turns out, was perfectly aware. He was smart enough to understand. He'd read the books. He learned what the French had done in Vietnam. He understood that it was a civil war and that, unfortunately, from his perspective, the North had seized and earned the legitimacy of sort of being the nationalist, anti-colonialist cause. And therefore, it was going to be very difficult to prosecute a war by supporting generals in the South against this nationalist movement. But nevertheless, he feared for domestic political reasons that Kennedy and Johnson, the presidents he was serving, could be tarred and feathered and weakened politically if they were seen to lose another Asian country. So he made a calculation. He convinced himself that, well, if we just make it appear that we're being strong as liberals, we're fighting back, we'll take gradual escalation, we'll step by step, and we won't get too involved. Well, the North Vietnamese weren't giving up. And gradual escalation turned into a big war. And then they were stuck. And, you know, that's the tragedy. It's always the tragedy that is interesting. So Bundy was, you know, at the time, he was allowing me to interview him about all this.
So he's very open about it.
Well, he was trying to write a memoir at the same time to explain what had happened.
So he wanted to get the story out.
He wanted to sort of get the story out.
At least his version.
His version of it, yeah. And unfortunately, he never finished the memoir. He died before he could finish it. So it never came out. Anyway, this is a long-winded answer to why I choose my subjects. But you see, it comes from a deep personal curiosity about the subject. And, you know, likewise Oppenheimer, and likewise I chose my good spy, Robert Ames, because I'd actually known him. He was my next-door neighbor in Saudi Arabia when I was 10, 11, 12 years old, and I knew him.
Did you know of the nature of his work?
No, I thought he was a regular Foreign Service officer, a diplomat like my father, and I only learned many years later when he was killed in Beirut that he was actually a CIA clandestine officer. So I was curious about...
That's a very close to home.
Yeah.
That's a story.
So do you know what my next project is?
Roy Cohn.
Mm.
I was actually going to ask you, because at different occasions you express you don't particularly like him. I can understand.
Right.
Again, I remember this interview with David McCullough. That's another reason he didn't write about Picasso, was he didn't like the guy.
Yeah.
And he said something about, like, you have to spend every day with him for years, so why pick someone you don't like? So here's my question to you. Why pick someone you don't like? And also, just sort of a footnote to that question, that I noticed that the subjects of your biographies also tend to come from this one period of history, even somehow related, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if that's intentional, or maybe just one project led to another.
I'm sort of a child of the Cold War. I was born in 1951. I grew up in that era. In the Vietnam era. And so, yeah, my interest has been to try to explain my contemporary world, including, you know, my time in the Middle East as a child. That's why I wrote a memoir about growing up there. So it's all personal motivation, you know. But Roy Cohn, I chose, well, first of all, you don't have to like or admire your subject.
No, I mean, it seems you're subjecting yourself to a lot of unpleasantness, maybe.
Yeah.
Sort of living in this person's head day after day. So there must be a very strong motivation then.
Yeah, Roy Cohn is not an admirable figure. He's kind of a scoundrel of a lawyer, as a very young man, he was general counsel to Joe McCarthy, so he was in the forefront of these McCarthyite witch hunts. He actually tried to subpoena Oppenheimer to come and testify, and yeah, he destroyed the lives of many decent Americans questioning their politics, and civil servants, the school teachers, and then he moves back to New York City where he grew up, and he becomes a divorce lawyer to the rich and famous, and then a lawyer to all five mob families in the mafia in New York City.
I really don't know much about this person, and for that matter, this period of history. But you're portraying him as almost this villain figure. Is that sort of consensus?
About Roy Cohn?
Yeah.
Yes, when in America, when I announce at a book event when we're talking about Oppenheimer, people ask me what my next biography is, and I say Roy Cohn. Usually there's a mass groan from the audience. Oh, no.
It's true, and I've seen a couple of those videos. But also you said about your the other person who you wrote about, then as you did your research, you changed your mind. I'm just wondering if there's a more complex story behind it.
Yeah. Yes. Well, the real story, the real reason to do Roy Cohn is that in 1973, he is sitting in a private dinner club, and at the next table is a young real estate developer named Donald Trump. And they become friends. Roy Cohn becomes his lawyer for the next dozen years. And he trains and molds Donald Trump into how to behave, how to deal with the press, how to escape the courts, how to not pay your taxes. I mean, it's like he makes Donald Trump into what we see in America today, this very divisive political figure. So Roy Cohn died in 1986 of AIDS. He was a gay man who was in the closet to the day he died. He denied that he was ever gay, but he was in his private life, he was openly gay.
There's a lot going on with this guy. Yeah.
And
another 800-page book, at least.
No, it's not going to be an 800-page book. I hope maybe 350 or 400. For one thing, he destroyed all his papers. Okay. So there's no archive. So it's going to take a lot of detective work to be able to tell the story. But it's possible, and I'm making progress. But you don't have to like your subject, but you do have to humanize them. So it's quickly becoming clear to me that Roy Cohn, the scoundrel of a lawyer, part of the way you can explain his behavior is precisely the fact that he was a gay man in the closet in the 1950s, when if he had announced his sexual identity, that would have destroyed him as a lawyer, as a public figure, as he wouldn't have been able to have a job. So this is, he's a deeply wounded, complicated, tragic figure in his own right. I'm doing interviews with people, some of his relatives, who explain his good side. So I'm going to tell his good side too.
For sure.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's not an interesting story. Just like it'd be a boring biography to choose a figure who is always successful and has no problems. And, likewise, if you choose an evil protagonist as your subject, if it's unrelenting evil that you're writing about, it makes it less interesting. You have to be able to humanize the figure, because we're all, complicated.
And I think that would be a great note to end this interview with. Humanize your subject.
Yes.
Any final comments for our listeners and readers of your book in China?
Well, I would just encourage your listeners to read more biography and to read more real newspapers and magazines, and don't get your news from social media.
Oh, I have to ask this then. You're the director of the Leon Levy Center for Biography.
Yes.
What does the center do? And do you see more, I was going to ask, do you see more biographies of scientists being written?
Yes. Well, the Leon Levy Center for Biography is very unique in America, I think it, in the world.
The one of a kind.
It's probably it's the only one. It's one of a kind. Yeah. I do no teaching. My job at the, it's housed at City University of New York Graduate Center. And all I do is promote the art and craft of biography by holding events, usually about 15 events a year, public events where we invite an audience in to meet a biographer who can talk about his new or her new biography. And I either interview them or I get someone appropriate to interview them on stage to promote their work. And then we give away 5 fellowships every year worth $72,000 each, you know, substantial money. And they get to have an office and library privileges. And we meet once a month to discuss common problems in the writing. And one of those 5 fellowships is always reserved now for a scientific figure. So we're specifically trying to encourage biographies of scientists.
Today's guest has been Kai Bird, author of the book American Prometheus. The book is available in Chinese, known as 奥本海默传. So yes, our listeners, read more biographies, go get the book. Thank you, Kai. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been a delightful conversation. Thank you for having me.
说一声你好，紧张不得了，你的脸上写满了纹。